Ballard's Mill. I go straight to my workroom. My mind is on Rebecca Foster. But when I reach for the diary, I find a note sitting on top and recognize Cyrus's loopy scrawl. I know you want to talk, but I've gone to the Hook with Moses to get some tallow that Amos saved for us. Not sure when I'll be back. Here there is an ink blot, as though he let the quill rest against the paper while he thought of what to say next. About Burgess. I guess you know he put his hands on Hannah. That's why I hit him. But if he's dead, I had nothing to do with it. I brought the girls home and went to bed. On my honor. C. I have only the children that I have. But if I've learned anything about raising young men, it's that some are liars and some are confessors. Cyrus is the latter. A confessor. In all the decades he's lived under our roof, I've never had a reason to doubt him. And I have none now. So I fold the note and set it to the side. Try to remember why I came in here. I have lost my train of thought. Cannot recall what I meant to find in the diary. This is the trouble faced by any woman who sets pen to paper in a busy household. I am never guaranteed the certainty of quiet, much less a solid length of time to chase my thoughts and bind them together. That is the luxury of men with libraries, butlers, and wives. Mothers find a different way to get their work done. Ha! There it is! A glimmer. I grab hold of the tail end of the thought as it skitters by, then chase it so that it won't evaporate. I look at the diary entry again. Flip back through the pages. Thursday, October 1. Clear, except some showers. We had company this afternoon. Mr. Savage here informs us that Mrs. Foster has sworn a rape on a number of men, among whom is Joseph North. Shocking indeed. I have been at home. I tap the entry with the pad of one finger. Contrary to my choice of wording, it wasn't the news itself that shocked me. I had attended Rebecca in the middle of August after the assault happened. Rather that she had gone public with the accusation without first consulting me. Rape is a capital offense in the States, punishable by hanging. But in all my 5 decades, I have seen only one man dangle at the end of a rope for that crime. It is nearly impossible to prove. And, until lately, most men caught doing so were dispatched before the courts could be involved. The recent War of Independence and the subsequent ratification of the Constitution has put a basic framework of laws in place to deal with such transgressions. There is more of a deterrent now to keep an aggrieved father or brother from taking justice into his own hands. I run my finger up the column to an entry from the day before, looking for insight into Rebecca's motives for speaking publicly. Wednesday, September 30. Clear except a light shower in the afternoon. I was called to Mr. Foster's door and asked some questions. Later, Colonel North interrogated me concerning what conversation Mrs. Foster had with me regarding his conduct. So perhaps not such strange timing after all. Rumor of the attack had begun to spread through the community, and North had likely gotten wind that people were talking. I flipped the pages again, farther back to August, when all of this began. Wednesday, August 19. Clear. Called at Mrs. Foster's. She complained to me that on August 10th, she had received great abuses from Joseph North and Joshua Burgess. After relating those abuses, she said that they could have done nothing worse unless they had killed her. She also said that North had abused her worse than any other person in the world had. But she believed it best to keep her troubles to herself as much as she could until her husband returned, which she had hoped would be soon. Came home at 1 p.m. Feel fatigued. Rebecca had kept her troubles to herself for almost 2 months after the attack, confiding only in me. It seemed wise at the time. I wanted Rebecca to have protection when she stepped forward with her allegation, so she told no one else until Isaac returned from Boston. The accused were respected men, and Rebecca might have found herself victimized further if she went forward on her own. In hindsight, however, the best evidence Rebecca had of the attack was the damage done to her body. Had she filed a complaint the day I found her, looking like a battered wreck, no one would have doubted her claims. And good God, it had been awful. For 9 days, Rebecca was so ill and sore that she could barely care for her own children. She couldn't bathe, was hardly able to eat. That is the woman that I found huddled in her home on August 19th. Yet by waiting all those weeks until Isaac returned, her outward injuries healed, and doubt was given time to grow roots. If I could do it differently, I would have taken Rebecca by wagon straight to the magistrates in Vassalboro the day I found her. My own lack of action makes me feel complicit in the way things have transpired. And now I fear that nothing can be done for the wounds Rebecca carries on the inside. Things have only gotten worse for my friend. Given what I learned this morning, I suspect that Rebecca feared a pregnancy in August. Saturday, August 22. Clear. I was at Mrs. Foster's. Left her as well as could be expected. Indians there. Tuesday, August 25. Clear. I went to see Mrs. Foster. I went to see Rebecca 3 times that week. I dressed her wounds, cooked her meals, and tended her children. And all the while, I tried to figure out what to do about the assault. Isaac was in Boston, seeking an intervention from the head of his congregation after being dismissed as minister in Hallowell over a series of theological differences. Sally Pierce, as it turns out, could not serve as a witness for Rebecca. During the month of August, she was tending her older sister and newborn niece at Fort Western. Husband gone, help gone, Rebecca was alone and vulnerable. Easy prey. But why? That is the thing I haven't yet been able to figure out. Why had North and Burgess committed such an egregious violent crime? They couldn't have believed she would keep it to herself, or that they would get away with it. I flip back to September 30, when I've been called to the parsonage by Isaac to answer that round of brooding questions concerning what happened to his wife. And then, later that afternoon, to my conversation with North, in which he asked for an accounting of every conversation I'd had with Isaac and Rebecca since August. I'd refused, of course. It was none of his business, and I wasn't obligated to tell him anything. But now Joshua Burgess is dead, and though Rebecca seemed relieved to hear the news, it came without any kind of real justice. I can't help but think of Isaac, locked away in his study writing letters. Has he been plotting revenge as well as professional vindication? And should I expect less from a man whose wife was so horribly violated? I set down my pen, pushed the journal away. Fretting over these questions will do no good. It is time to speak with my husband. In summer, the path down to the mill is worn and wide from years of ballered feet walking back and forth. But in winter, it is little more than a channel between snowbanks, packed hard by heavy-soled boots. It winds through the pasture, into the woods, and toward the creek. Pine and sumac grow along its sides, along with patches of pennyroyal. But the dark mint-shaped leaves have long since dried and fallen, which is a pity because I nearly ran through my supply delivering the last Prescott girl. Concoction of pennyroyal helps calm excited nerves, and I find it useful when delivering a Prescott. Screamers, every one of them. 2 of the 3 girls are expecting in the spring, and I dread attending the births. They learn such hysterics from their mother. The woods are quiet today, and I miss the melodic, tinkling sound of the water wheel outside the mill. Locked in the ice, the wheel won't turn again until the thaw, and that makes Ephraim's job more difficult. The wheel helps power the long saws, but now it will be Ephraim and our sons heaving their way through every log. Now that the river has frozen, he and the boys will have to make their deliveries by land instead, an arduous, time-consuming task that will leave them all exhausted and testy. Lucky me. I run a fingertip over a bright red burst of sumac berries, reminded how I love this path in winter. The combination of verdant pine boughs and blazing berries is striking against the snow, a well-earned bit of showmanship for outlasting all the other plants and shrubs. I make a mental note to come back later and harvest the sumac. When ripe, the berries make an excellent lemon-tinged spice for meats and vegetables, and I think Dolly might like to add some to the roast we'll be having for dinner tonight. But I won't collect them all, as the berries are also a favorite source of winter food for rabbits and foxes. I pause mid-step on the path. The fox. I mustn't forget to tell Ephraim about our unnerving visitor. Was it only a few hours ago? I feel as though a month of Sundays has passed since I arrived home. This is what it means to age, I think. The days are long, but the years are short. The oddness of my encounter with the fox still feels like a portent of some kind, a lingering in the air like a fog that doesn't burn away with the midday sun. Ephraim will neither laugh at me nor be alarmed. He will simply nod and think on it, the way he does with most things. If I give him enough time, he might even have an explanation. Some men think in a straight line, like an arrow off the string. They go to logic, to the easy conclusion, and avoid the waterways of the mind. But not Ephraim. His head is all rivers and streams, and with a mind like that, a thought could run anywhere. He will have an answer, he always does. Our lumber mill is set into the bank of Mill Creek, on stone foundations right where the current is strongest. It is large. Larger than our barn, in fact. The first floor has ample space to store and dry a great deal of cut timber, plus additional workspace for Ephraim. The second floor comprises a loft that runs the length of the mill and looks over the space below. Ephraim has even built a convenient staircase to access it for when we host a large gathering. There are few things more awkward, after all, than sending ladies up a ladder in their skirts. Several years ago, Ephraim counterbalanced a wide, sturdy deck against the building so that it stretches over the water. No more dragging the boards down to the creek and standing knee-deep in mud while they are bound. Now he sends them straight off the pier and into the current below. They make a terrible splash, but they right easily and begin their journey toward the Kennebec, and then on to Hollowell, Farmingdale, and farther south, through Bath, and onto the shipyards in Boston, then to parts unknown. I like to think that there are vessels sailing the Atlantic made of boards sawn by my husband and sons. I like to think that we have contributed something to the wider world. On the other side of the mill, out of sight, is a large wooden mews attached to the exterior wall and accessible only by an inside door. Ephraim built it to house Percy, a peregrine falcon he found as a fledgling 5 years ago, and I can hear the bird now calling for his lunch. My husband looks up and smiles when I slip through the door. "Hello, love," he says. Ephraim crosses the floor in three long strides and places a warm kiss in the dip between my eyebrows. In his youth, he'd had black hair and eyes the color of a summer sky. A straight Welsh nose, square jaw. His eyes and jaw are still as strong as the day I first met him, but his hair is streaked with silver, and his nose slightly crooked thanks to a dirty punch he received 14 years ago. After a momentary glance in which he inspects me for soundness of life and limb, he asks, "Have you finally come to tell me what in blazes happened this morning?
Did Moses not say anything when he came to get Cyrus?"
"No, why?"
"Then I suppose he had words with you about Hannah."
Ephraim laughs. "No, he's working up to it, though. It withers a lad finding the courage for that conversation, but he'll get there. Stayed and talked for a bit, though, and made sure to catch a glimpse of her before driving off. I think about the body of Joshua Burgess and the assistance that Moses rendered this morning. And did he mention nothing else while he was here? He grins.
Only that you would have news for me when you returned. But when I pressed him, he insisted that you would want to give me the details yourself. So I can only conclude one thing.
Which is?
You have done something to earn that boy's loyalty.
I've done something.
Charmed him in some way, I suspect. You tend to do that.
I do no such thing. Most people dislike me, as a matter of fact.
They respect you. Perhaps occasionally fear you, it's not the same thing.
And miles away from charm.
I find you charming.
You are biased. I laugh and am grateful for the lightness it brings to my chest. Good humor stretches out from the corners of Ephraim's eyes in the form of crow's feet, and I realize he has lightened my mood on purpose. I must have come into the mill with a storm cloud hanging above my head. And Moses wants to court Hannah, I add.
That's hardly news.
Well, he now sees me as the door he must go through.
And here, I thought I had the honor.
I snort. It seems that the young Pollard and I have bonded.
Over what?
A body. Outside, the squawking grows louder and the falcon mews, accompanied by the heavy beat of large wings. Percy is hungry, I say, looking to the far wall and the door that leads beyond.
You can't change subjects like that, love. I did hear mention of a body.
Well, your bird is loud and distracting. Feed him, then I'll tell you. Ephraim grins, then strides across the floor to where a large bucket sits beside the wood stove. He plucks out a wriggling blueback trout with his bare hand and opens the door that accesses the mews. Percy hops across the floor and plucks the thing right out of Ephraim's fingers. He's a handsome bird, with pointed wings and a long tail. His feathers are a blue-gray above and a speckled brown beneath. Percy puffs his white breast and turns his head so that the black, mustache-like markings on his face are visible. He always looks French to me, and pompous. Task accomplished, Ephraim shuts the door, turns to me again, and crosses his arms over his chest, waiting.
I try to ignore the sound of ripping flesh coming from the mews.
Where to start, and how to explain everything. I take a deep breath and let my shoulders settle, stretch my neck side to side, then begin the best way I know how. You know that while I was with Betsy Clark, Jonathan's raft got trapped in the ice at Bumberhook Point, and that Sam Darwin fell through while they were trying to get to shore. He nods.
I helped Jonathan get him into the girl's bed.
Did you know that he saw a body when he went under? Or that Jonathan sent James Wall to get men from the hook to cut it from the ice?
I did not.
Ephraim's jaw twitches.
Who is the dead man?
I never said it was a man.
Then who's dead?
I'm getting to that.
Rather slowly, I'd say.
Hush, I'm trying to sort out the details so they'll make sense. The small wood stove spreads what little warmth it can through the mill, and I drift closer, palms outstretched before continuing. Amos Pollard sent James to collect me from the Clarks. They'd gotten the body out, taken it to the tavern. Amos wanted me to inspect him before Dr. Coney was summoned.
Him? So it was a man, like I said.
Well, you assumed, but that's beside the point. Women get murdered too, you know.
Murdered?
I'll get to that as well if you won't interrupt.
Go on, then. Tell me what man has been murdered in Hollowell,
Ephraim says. It's not so much the news he's enjoying, but our banter, and I note the flash of humor in his eyes. I pause, giving import to the name before I speak it. Joshua Burgess. Ephraim looks as shocked as he is capable of. His eyes widen for a moment and his nostrils flare. Beyond that, he is as impassive as a stump.
Ah,
he says.
Well, that complicates things.
He'd been beaten and hanged Ephraim. Someone killed him before they threw him in the river.
Well,
he scratches his scalp, contemplating.
There are a number of men in this town who would want to hang him.
This is the hardest thing I must ask him today, but Ephraim and I are not in the habit of shrinking away from difficult subjects. Is our son one of them?
And there it is,
the stillness that overcomes my husband when he is afraid.
Which son? And what do you mean?
Have you not spoken with your daughters this morning?
His eyes narrow. Only a quick good morning when Dolly brought my breakfast.
And she said nothing of Hannah.
Hannah is coming up an awful lot just now, and no, Dolly did not mention her sister. Why?
Because Burgess hurt her at the frolic last night. Ephraim stiffens and takes one threatening step forward, and I hold out a hand, palm flat, to stop him from combusting. Everything is fine. Cyrus handled it, thrashed him soundly from what I hear. But the fact remains that Joshua Burgess tried to force Hannah to dance, and he had to be evicted from the frolic. Dozens of people witnessed it. And when news of Burgess's death spreads, so will that fact.
And you think they'll come for Cyrus?
Him or Isaac Foster?
There's another man who would benefit directly from Burgess's death.
Yes. The fewer people who take the stand in Vassalboro, the better for Joseph North. Ephraim nods slowly, letting that idea take root.
When did James Wall arrive at the Clarks?
I shrug. About 5 o'clock.
Is it possible that North already knew?
Perhaps. There was smoke rising from his chimney when I arrived in the Hook. Someone could have told him. Or he could have heard the commotion, seen them bringing the body to the tavern. Again, Ephraim nods.
Or he could have been there when Burgess went into the river. Could have done it himself.
The possibility has occurred to me as well. We aren't the only ones who will wonder about that.
Accusing and proving are different things. A cause of death would have to be declared, evidence brought forth.
A sly grin creeps across my face, which is, no doubt, why Amos Pollard summoned me this morning. Tomorrow is the last Friday of the month. The Court of General Sessions is meeting.
In his tavern, no less. Clever bastard.
And having examined Joshua Burgess, I can declare cause of death. Ephraim closes the short distance between us. He pulls me against his chest and buries his face in my neck. I can feel him draw in a long breath through his nose, take in my scent, and then a wave of warm air brushes across my skin as he exhales. As is his habit, Ephraim slides his hand into the mound of hair at the base of my skull and pulls out a single curl. He winds it around his finger, then lets it spring free. He does this several times as he ponders the situation.
It seems you've had quite a morning.
And you've not even heard the half of it. He chuckles into my skin.
Dare I ask?
Oh, nothing quite so dramatic as a half-drowned man and a dead body. But I did see a fox when I got home.
I thought I heard one barking.
The fox was black, not red.
A silver fox, then. Those are rare indeed. Some call them ghost foxes.
Well, she didn't look like much of a ghost to me. She was quite real. And she was on the rise leading to the south pasture, near the live oak. I pause, feeling foolish, but Ephraim presses a hand to the small of my back, urging me to continue. The thing is, there were two trappers at Coleman's this morning when I stopped in. They were talking about that fox. And there she is, waiting for me when I get home. You must admit that's odd. He doesn't comment one way or another. They know that fox is here, I tell him. They're hunting it.
It's called poaching when it's on private land. I'll keep an eye out for them. They'll be back, no doubt.
They'd run that risk?
You can shoot a poacher on sight. One silver fox is worth 40 beaver skins, love. And trappers aren't known for keeping to a strict moral code.
There's something different about this one.
How so?
I couldn't shake the feeling that she was here for me.
Why?
Because of the way she looked at me. I was debating whether to come speak with you or go check on Sam. She kept looking at me, then back to the house, like Sam was more important.
I glance up to see if he's laughing, but he isn't. Those bright blue eyes meet my gaze, and there's no teasing tilt to his mouth. I've never seen a silver fox, you know. Alive, that is. But if one came to you, it's worth noting. Foxes don't come to people naturally. And if you ask the Wabanaki, they would tell you that it is a sign.
Of what?
Ephraim keeps his hand on my back but turns his face to the window. Only a rectangle of forest and snowbank can be seen through it. But he peers out intensely. The native people believe that the fox presents itself only in times of great uncertainty, that it acts as a guide. And what about you? Do you believe that? I believe, he says carefully, that you have had a strange morning and that you should not discount anything.
Indians there. I gasp and sit up straight on my stool as though I've been bitten. And perhaps I have, but only by a thought. Little details connect themselves, reaching for one another, forming a theory in my mind. It is well known within Hollowell that Rebecca Foster often keeps company with the Wabanaki. She has since childhood, encouraged by her parents at the parochial school they ran in Massachusetts. They'd kept progressive ideals of educating the native population, of building a partnership between the two cultures, and Rebecca has maintained the practice of opening her door to them since moving to this community with her husband a few years ago. It is not uncommon to see them at the parsonage. But as with most things concerning Rebecca Foster, her neighbors are split in opinion regarding this habit. There seems to be little about her that does not cause division in Hollowell.
What are you doing? Ephraim whispers. He stands at the door to my workroom, shirtless, barefoot, wearing only trousers that are unlaced and hang low on his hips. Until 3 minutes ago, I'd been sitting at the dressing table in our bedroom, brushing my hair, when I'd suddenly grabbed the candle and left the room. I came in here to flip back pages in the diary. I went to see Rebecca Foster this morning. I wanted her to hear the news about Joshua Burgess from me. He leans against the doorframe, but says nothing. And when I got home, something was bothering me about Burgess and the Foster case. So I went back through my entries to try and remember details. Those two things are braided together, I'm certain of it. Ephraim comes to stand beside me. He reaches out and runs his hand through my hair.
A braid has 3 strands, love.
Which means I'm missing one.
Or maybe you are tired, reaching for meaning where there is none.
I don't think I'm wrong in this. Here, I poke my finger at the diary entry.
Ephraim reads it aloud.
Saturday, August 22nd. Clear. I was at Mrs. Foster's, left her well as could be expected. Indians there.
He peers at me in the dim light.
Indians?
You know that Rebecca has befriended them.
Aye, that's no secret. Indians are there often, I would guess.
But you also know that there are many in Hollowell who hate her for it. They think it unbecoming a woman of her station, and an insult given all that happened during the French and Indian War.
He nods, uncertain where I'm headed with this.
Who do you know that is better with herbs than I am?
No one, except
the Wabanaki.
I can see that I've lost him completely now.
I found a tin that smelled of savin and tansy in Rebecca's parlor. It was empty.
Still that steady gaze, but no questions.
Tansy brings the menzies, but savin induces labor. It's hard to find and harder to harvest. The concoction must be prepared carefully and administered in specific doses.
Now he is curious. Have you ever used this?
Only when a woman has gone past her time, and even then only twice. It makes for a painful labor, and if you are not careful, can cause uncontrolled bleeding.
What are you trying to say?
Rebecca Foster is pregnant, she told me this morning. The child isn't Isaac's. Ephraim looks at the entry again, does the math.
12 days after she was raped, Rebecca took Savin to end a possible pregnancy. You think the Wabanaki gave her the herbs?
It's only a guess.
He shrugs. It's not a bad one.
It is nearing midnight. I can feel it, the way my muscles seem to hang limp on my bones, the way my eyes have gone dry and my neck aches. But I've resumed my place at the dressing table regardless, running the boar bristle brush through my hair. I do this every night, 200 strokes, brushing, brushing until my hair crackles with static electricity. I love the way my scalp tingles, the way my hair slips smooth through my fingers afterward. It is the only way to tame my curls. Ephraim is stretched out in bed, watching me. After a moment, he sighs. He wears nothing now, waiting for me to come to bed. I turn around, match him leer for leer.
I'm glad you chose me, he says.
As I recall, you did the choosing.
No, I did the courting. But it wouldn't have mattered a bit if you hadn't wanted me in return. Any man worth his salt knows it's a woman who does the choosing, and anyone who thinks differently is a fool.
A small mirror, chipped and distorted with age, sits on the table. I turn back to it, laughing as I see his grin in the reflection, and move a section of hair above my right ear to inspect a thick streak of silver hidden beneath the part. I lift it, coiling the hair around my finger, marveling at this single patch of silver. Ephraim shifts on the bed, and I hear the soft pad of feet on the floorboards.
I like it,
he says, lifting the streak from my hand. He slides it through his fingers. It is one thing to be old, I tell him, and another to feel old. That makes me feel old.
Well, it makes me feel like a king.
He smiles at my curious look.
Only a fool would be upset to find a vein of silver running through his beloved territory.
Well, is it any surprise that we had 9 children?
Not to me.
Not with a man who whispers such things in my ear as he stands an inch away, warm and naked. Ephraim drops my hair and reaches for my hand.
Come to bed, love.
Some things change in 35 years of marriage. The silver hair, the softness of my belly, the lines around my eyes. But some things do not, and I am still eager for the warmth of my husband's touch. I go with him gladly and smile as he blows out the candle. Pollard's Tavern, Friday, November 27. A large crowd has gathered in the Hook. The Court of General Sessions draws any number of busybodies eager for distraction and a morsel of gossip to Pollard's Tavern. They sit in clusters, elbows propped on the heavy wooden tables, flagons in hand, or they lean against the wall, whispering and picking mud from their boots. Ours is a community of first, second, and third generation immigrants, and the conversations reflect this diversity. Those gathered speak primarily in English with varied accents, but jocular bursts of German, French, and Spanish rise above the din as well. Abigail Pollard sits perched on a 3-legged stool beside the blazing hearth, a kerchief tucked into her cleavage. As the room fills and the temperature rises, she plucks it out, mops it across her brow, and returns it to her bodice. Amos Pollard takes advantage of the uptick in patronage, buzzing through the tavern, serving rum and ale, beer and cider to his customers. He laughs at a joke, slaps a friend on the shoulder, greets this patron and that. There is good reason that Amos has never insisted the court holds session elsewhere. Court days increase his monthly profits by a wide margin. Joseph North, Colonel North on most days, has donned the moniker of judge for this occasion, and he enjoys the power and dignity that come with the role. The state of Massachusetts gave him the title 20 years ago for his service during the war against the French and Indians, and while I have always found him insufferable in court, today has the added complication of being the first time I've come before North since Rebecca Foster went public with her accusation. As is tradition, the fourth Friday of each month is set aside to deal with petty local issues, complaints of Sabbath breaking, use of profanity, charges of fornication, small grievances and domestic issues. Twice a year, North gathers with the other circuit judges assigned to Lincoln County for the Court of Common Pleas. These sessions take place 13 miles to the north in Vassalboro and cover more serious crimes such as theft, slander, tax liens, and assault. Likewise, the Supreme Judicial Court also meets twice a year and draws a great deal more attention as it presides over murder trials and any appeals from the Court of Common Pleas. These cases are tried to the south, in Palnoboro, the only town nearby with a proper courthouse and jail, and are presided over by a set of esteemed lawyers who travel from Boston. It is a haphazard and somewhat lax judicial system, but our need is slight, and we are grateful to have whatever justice we can get. Judge North, however, treats all sessions with the same sense of pomp and pageantry. He wears the required wig and red silk robe, buttoned to the top, and a ruffled collar that has turned yellow with age. It hangs against his throat like a limp rag. I shift closer to the front of the room, ready to give my testimony and be gone. There is an open spot on a long bench near the fire, and I take a seat. I don't see Ephraim until he removes his hat. He stands, leaning against a column in the shadows by the door, arms crossed over his chest. Anyone else would take the look he gives me as disinterest, possibly boredom. But I know my husband well enough to detect the curious tightening around his eyes and the clenching of his jaw. After so many years together, his every movement, word, and hesitation are as clear to me as the lines drawn on one of his maps. Ephraim is uneasy. He wouldn't be here otherwise. A smattering of women sit behind me, gossiping, waiting for their men to lodge complaints or defend themselves from the same. William Pierce is at a table with his daughter Sally, whispering intently. I can see three of the men who helped pull Burgess from the ice. They've all found seats near one another, and they pass furtive glances back and forth. Henry Sewell, the town clerk, slides into his seat beside North, ready to take notes and keep account of any fines assigned or paid. Other men drift in and out. A baby cries somewhere, and two children bicker over the last apple on one of the tables.
The Court of General Sessions is now open, North says with authority, then whacks the table once with his gavel.
I'd planned to wait until the end of the session, give my statement just before the court dismisses, but North has other plans. He saw me enter, has been watching me ever since.
You have business, Mistress Ballard?
He looks directly at me, challenging. Then everyone else does as well. I stand, clear my throat. I have evidence to give in a legal cause.
What manner?
This is a formality, a show put on for the benefit of those present. There is typically only one reason that I attend court meetings, and the citizens of Hollowell know this quite well. When an unwed woman gives birth, it is my duty before the law to ask and record the name of the father while the woman is in travail. The legal presumption is that, under such physical duress, a woman cannot lie. Clearly, the writers of the law know little about women and nothing about childbirth. I could give them endless examples of the lies that have been spoken to me through gritted teeth as women heave their children into the world. Regardless, the law, passed 4 years ago by the Massachusetts General Assembly, is bluntly titled An Act for the Punishment of Fornication and for the Maintenance of Bastard Children. It was designed to make sure that unwed mothers had a means of providing for their children, but in practice, it is little more than a ritual of public shaming. Of all the responsibilities required by my profession, this is my least favorite. Should a girl refuse to name her child's father, she will be fined and possibly jailed for 24 hours.
Should she cooperate, the girl will still be fined, but will not face the indignity of a night spent in the clink. Repeat offenders find themselves subject to higher fines and longer sentences. Yet the men involved in these cases escape both forms of punishment. There is no law pertaining to male fornication, unless one considers being forced to provide for one's own child a punishment. Had the tavern been empty, North would have gotten directly to the point. But since he has a large audience, he drags out the proceedings. I indulge his showmanship, knowing the assumption every other person in this room has already made. Another illegitimate birth. Another declaration of paternity. A bit of juicy gossip for the neighborhood to gnaw on for a few days. I dip my head in feigned respect. I come before the Court of General Sessions to deliver testimony regarding a death, as is my duty before the law and the state of Massachusetts. Well-rehearsed words. I need to be careful. A wave of mutterings rises behind me.
What death?
North asks, his eyes tightening at the corners. Joshua Burgess. Now the wave crashes ashore in a full-blown cacophony. North bangs his gavel on the table to regain order. When the room is silent once more, I continue. Joshua Burgess was found yesterday morning, caught in the ice off Bumberhook Point. I was called to this establishment to examine the body and render my opinion on cause of death. Ephraim shifts uneasily in my peripheral vision when he hears the cool note in North's voice.
And what is your opinion, Mistress Ballard, on cause of death?
North asks.
Murder.
Gasps, mutters, exclamations. These sounds erupt behind me, along with stools clattering backward, men springing to their feet. Several tankards tip over, and I hear the steady drip of ale splashing on the flagstone floor. Deaths are far too common in these parts, but murder is rare. I remain standing, expression as still and disinterested as I can manage. I keep my eyes on North, and he holds the gaze, locks it in place with his own. Beside him, Henry Sewell glances between us, his quill hovering above the record book he keeps for the court. It takes several seconds of gavel banging before order is restored.
That is a weighty charge, Mistress Ballard.
I charge nothing. I only state my findings. I stand straight and tall and speak with confidence. Bruises covered his face, torso, and groin. Several teeth were broken. It was clear he had been beaten badly while still alive. He had numerous broken bones. His neck was snapped, windpipe exposed, and rope burns were evident in a complete circle beneath his chin. It was obvious that, after being beaten, Joshua Burgess was hanged. I do not believe he was alive when thrown into the river. North stares at me, his dark eyes turned to flint, but I can't interpret the expression on his face. His voice sounds impartial when he asks,
How can you be sure that he was thrown in?
Oh, you bastard. You have never questioned my testimony before, I think. Then carefully say, It is a deduction based on the evidence.
And have you ever seen a man hanged, Mistress Ballard?
Yes. This astonishes me, coming from him, and I'm not afraid to show it. He of all people should know the answer to that question.
I have.
I ignore the disruption behind me, pay no attention to the standing, whispering, muttering crowd at my back. So intent am I on North, eager to identify the fleeting expression that crosses his face, that I don't notice the man who has come to stand beside me until he speaks.
Your Honor, he says, if I may address the court, I too have information pertinent to the situation.
Dr. Page. Damn it. Damn it all to hell. When Judge North speaks again, I finally recognize the look I hadn't been able to identify. Certainty.
Of course. Please state your name and profession for the court records.
Dr. Benjamin Page, licensed physician and Harvard Medical School graduate.
The crowd gathered at Pollard's Tavern is adequately impressed. They murmur and nod their approval, lean forward, assess the man with curiosity. Several of the younger women sit up straighter, watch him with acute interest. They are looking for a wedding ring, any sign that he has spoken for. Despite my irritation, I can't deny that this is an excellent way for a new physician to advertise his services.
Carry on, Dr. Page, North says, his voice louder, imperious. The court always respects the word of a trained medical professional.
I, too, inspected the body of Joshua Burgess yesterday, but I'm afraid my findings are quite different from those of Mistress Ballard.
North lifts a hand, palm up, and waves it, giving him the floor.
Please explain.
I curl my fingers inward, stopping just short of making a fist, as I turn my steady gaze to Dr. Page. He steps into the open area before the table, but speaks only to North.
While it is true that the body in question does show some injury, I believe this is due to being swept downstream amidst ice and debris. A great deal of damage can happen to a body in churning water. In addition, there was no rope on or near the body of Mr. Burgess that would indicate a hanging. It is my professional opinion that he died from drowning, most likely due to intoxication, and that all injuries were incurred in a post-mortem state.
Page folds his hands across his stomach, as though he has just delivered a lecture on human anatomy, complete with appropriate Latin terminology, to a rapt classroom. Post-mortem. It doesn't take a linguist to decipher the definition of that word, but Page knows that it makes him sound knowledgeable and qualified before the court. After a moment, North clears his throat.
Mistress Ballard?
Yes.
When you inspected the body, did you find a rope on or near his person?
I did not.
And the men who found him, did they see a rope?
No.
You inquired about this?
I did.
Because you found it curious as well.
It was something I noted given the rope burns on his neck. I slide my eyes to the left and see the faint flicker of a crooked smile warp the corner of Dr. Page's mouth. I do not consider myself a scribe of any repute. I am a chronicler of facts, not feelings. However, the knowing look that passes between North and Page inspires a sort of enraged doggerel that Shakespeare himself might salute with his quill. Thou crusty, open-arsed, babbling liar. Thou craven, hag-born maltworm. Thou dankish, prick-faced, leprous carrion.
North steeples his fingers beneath his chin, considers. Rope burns without a rope? Is it possible you misinterpreted what you saw, Mistress Ballard?
It's possible the rope came off in the water, or was cut away, or reclaimed.
I see.
North smirks, then scribbles something onto a sheet of paper and hands it to Henry Sewell. Clearly, Page had been sent to Pollard's not only to contradict my assessment, but to follow behind and interrogate the witnesses on all that transpired before his arrival. I curse myself for having left so quickly yesterday. I should have stayed with the body until he left. The tavern is silent now, all eyes on the three of us in our battle of wills. I stare at the doctor. Page looks only to North. But when North speaks again, his words and gaze are directed at me.
I thank you both for coming today and for taking such care to examine the late Mr. Burgess. May he rest in peace. But after hearing the evidence, it is the court's decision that the death of Joshua Burgess was an accidental drowning, as stated by Dr. Page.
This matter is settled. Mr. Sewell, please record these findings in the official record.
He looks to the crowd.
Who is next?
I do not stay to hear some ridiculous complaint one neighbor might have against another for taking the Lord's name in vain. Truth be told, I am more than a little tempted to do so myself. So I turn on my heel and walk away. I have half a mind to request that Amos Pollard drag Joshua Burgess into the tavern so the entire town can see for themselves. There is no possible way the river did that damage to his body. But I am halfway to the door, Ephraim moving to intercept me, when an idea flashes bright through my mind. Wait! I stop, turn, take one step back toward North.
I can hear Ephraim curse under his breath directly behind me. My decision is final, Mistress Ballard.
North's composure is broken now, his voice louder than necessary.
I understand that, and I am not challenging your decision. I simply ask that Mr. Sewell record in the official court documents that there are contradicting views as to the cause of Mr. Burgess's death. One that states accidental drowning. I pause for effect. And one that states murder.
I don't think it is my right before the law and the state of Massachusetts to request this.
I give him the smile held in reserve for my enemies. As a trained medical professional.
I am correct on this point. North knows it. And so do any number of other people in the room. As a midwife, I am granted a unique legal status most women do not enjoy. If he publicly refuses me, I will have cause to appeal to a higher court. And, should things grow contentious, North could be stripped of his appointment as judge for failing to uphold established law. He does not capitulate immediately, however, but rather twists his mouth in calculation for several seconds. Seeing no way out of it, he finally says,
"Very well. Mr. Sewell, please note that my verdict lies with Dr. Page's assessment, but that there is, as Mistress Ballard has noted, a contradicting opinion."
Henry Sewell bends his head over the ledger, and I turn to leave once more. Ephraim now stands at the door waiting, my riding cloak over his arm, and an expression of urgency spread across his face. I hear Judge North call William Pierce forward.
"What is your complaint, Mr. Pierce?"
"I am here with my daughter, Sally, Your Honor, and she has two charges to make."
Again, I slow, stop, turn. Again, Ephraim curses, but audibly this time.
"Miss Pierce, what is your charge?"
North asks. Sally's voice is shaky, and she has to clear her throat to get the words out.
"I bring charges of fornication, Your Honor."
Now Ephraim is at my side, fist clenching the back of my dress, whispering,
"Don't,"
in my ear.
"No, no, no, please, no," I think.
I rise onto my tiptoes to get a glimpse of Sally over the crowd. The girl is staring at the ground, face crimson, lips pinched together in shame. William Pierce stands beside his daughter, one hand on her back, and I can see his fingers squeezing the small muscle in the dip between shoulder and neck.
"Against whom do you bring these charges?"
"Against my employer, Mrs. Rebecca Foster.
I have been delivering testimony in this room on the last Friday of each month for a decade, but never, in all of that time, have there been two such scandalous occurrences, and certainly not on the same day. The people of Hollowell will be chewing on this bone for years." William Pierce steps in front of his daughter.
"I told Sally to give her notice this morning, Your Honor, because it has come to my attention that Mrs. Foster is pregnant by a man not her husband. Sally heard her admit to this yesterday, and I feel that to remain in the Foster's employ would be a blight upon my daughter's character."
"That doe-eyed little traitor," I hiss,
and Ephraim has to loop his arm around my waist to stop me from lunging forward.
"Rebecca isn't even here to defend herself."
"We need to go,"
Ephraim says, the tone of his voice brooking no argument. Right now.
Mr. Sewell, will you please note in the court records that Mrs. Rebecca Foster, wife of Reverend Isaac Foster, has been formally charged with a gross and immoral sin of fornication.
While Henry Sewell records this charge, North leans forward and rests his elbows on the table.
What is your second charge, Miss Pierce?
She is terrified. That much is obvious. Murder. There is no outburst this time. Only the sound of Sally's feet shuffling across the flagstone floor as her father pushes her closer to the table.
In addition to saying that she was pregnant, I also heard Mistress Foster say that her husband did kill Joshua Burgess.
Now there are gasps of astonishment, whispers. Dr. Page takes a step back, glowers at her. I can see him try to figure out a way to explain his miscalculation.
No!
I am astonished at the sound of my voice. As is everyone else in the tavern, for the room falls suddenly quiet and all heads swivel to look at me.
That is not at all what Rebecca said.
Mistress. Ballard, North growls.
The reason Sally heard our conversation is because she was listening at the door while I was there yesterday. Did you hear me? I was there. Go on, ask her. No one does. And both she and her father remain silent, though her eyes fill with frightened tears. It is clear Sally did not want to do this, but it is already done, and I feel no mercy for her. North leans forward.
Mistress Ballard, I will not tolerate such an outburst in my courtroom.
I ignore him. What Rebecca said is that she hoped Isaac had killed the man. And can any of you blame her? A look around the tavern, then take a step forward and glare at North.
Can you blame her?
Enraged now, he brings his gavel down with a hard whack.
This is an obscene disruption.
No, it is an obscene miscarriage of justice.
Whack. Rebecca is not here to defend herself against these charges. Whack.
This foolish little ninny came in on the last half of a sentence and thinks she heard a confession?
No. She's nothing more than an eavesdropper. Whack.
You should not be presiding over this matter, I tell North. You are one of the men accused of raping Rebecca Foster. Whack, whack.
Henry Sewell sits beside the judge, pen held in midair, mouth open in astonishment.
And you,
I turn and point my finger directly in Sally's face. You should be ashamed of yourself, you gossiping little liar. Do you have any idea the harm you've just done?
Whack, whack, whack.
I feel Ephraim's hand on the small of my back. There is a tug, urging me to leave. But no, I am too angry, too full of spitting fury to acknowledge him.
Mistress Ballard!
North's voice is filled with thunder now, and it is the only thing that breaks through the roar in my mind.
You are in contempt of court. Mr. Ballard, remove your wife from my presence immediately.
The air outside the tavern is clean and cold, without the slightest tinge of wood smoke. I can almost taste the frost on my tongue, the bite of winter settling into my lungs.
What were you thinking?
Ephraim hisses in my ear as he pulls me down the steps and toward the stables. I don't bother keeping my voice down.
I couldn't let her stand there and lie about Rebecca.
Hush!
Ephraim warns as a crowd of people spill out of the tavern. Their heads are bent low, whispering. Several of them look toward us, then away.
And that helped? What you just did?
I spoke the truth.
And got kicked out of court. Everything else you accomplished today could well be dismissed.
He wouldn't dare.
Ephraim leads me through the stable door and toward the stalls where Sterling and Brutus wait for us. He pulls a shilling from his pocket and hands it to young Matthew Pollard, the stable boy. Like Moses, he looks like their father, though at the moment he is only dark and lanky. The big and brooding will take some years yet.
You just gave him the advantage, Martha. North could do anything now.
I'm not a woman given easily to tears. They're useless things that serve only to make your voice waver and your cheeks wet. But they accost me now, and I push them away with the back of my hand.
I couldn't stand there and do nothing. I couldn't. I won't.
When Matthew Pollard leads the horses away to saddle them, Ephraim sighs. He drops his forehead to mine.
You are too involved in this.
I never asked to be.
And I would never ask you to turn away from a friend, but that was reckless, Martha. That was dangerous. You called North a rapist in his own courtroom.
I said nothing that isn't already on the record, that isn't being whispered about in this town.
Behind closed doors, yes. But you said it to his face.
And you think it's better to whisper behind a man's back?
I think it's better to be prudent in your speech, measured.
Suddenly you're afraid to look a man in the eye and call him what he is? My husband flinches, looks away.
That was a long time ago.
It was no time at all. Yesterday. Just a moment. It is only ever a breath away from me. And I saw the truth of that when North asked if I'd ever seen a man hanged. He knows I have. He was there when it happened. And so were you.
35 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts. December 19, 1754. Billy Crane jerked at the end of his rope. He'd pissed himself, most likely when the trap door fell, and a dark stain ran the length of his right leg. The drop was supposed to break his neck, but he was a tall man, and I could see that the rope hadn't fully done its job. His back was arched, and one foot twitched. I looked away, but Ephraim's hand lay soft against my cheek, gently forcing my gaze back to the gallows.
No, he said. Watch it to the end.
I tried to shake loose, but he leaned closer, insistent, mouth brushing my ear.
This is justice, Martha. You need to see it done.
No one needs to see this, I thought. But Ephraim held me still. The crowd gathered in the clearing below was silent, collectively holding its breath until the spasms stopped. I saw my parents before the tree, staring up at the twisting form of Crane, murder in their eyes. Only when the hangman cut the rope and let Crane's body drop to the ground with a heavy thud did Ephraim turn me into the wide shelter of his chest. And then I was crying, my voice muffled by the sharp December wind and the heavy linen of his shirt. I pummeled him with my fists until they ached, but Ephraim did not defend himself, or hold me, or say a word of comfort. We stood on a rise above the clearing, hidden beneath a copse of fir trees, the crowd below oblivious to our presence. So intent were they on the scene before them, there hadn't been a public hanging in those parts for almost 10 years, and my father had forbid me to attend this one. Private hangings, the ones motivated by revenge, were far more common, however. Grisly, barbaric. Father used several other words to describe the process, none of them fit for a woman's ears. But, I thought, he had forgotten to include riveting. He would lock me away for a year if he knew I'd seen them hang Billy Crane. Father had forced me to lay a hand on the family Bible and swear that I would not set foot out the door until Billy had been put in the ground to rot. And I would have obeyed if it weren't for Ephraim Ballard. He came to fetch me after my parents left, and I could no more refuse him than cease breathing. Finally, after I exhausted myself, Ephraim pushed my tears away with his thumbs and cupped my face in his hands. He looked at me as though I might shatter. He looked at me as though he was willing to pick up each and every piece if I did, as though he would put them back together with his own bleeding fingers. Ephraim offered one curt nod.
It's done then. He's dead.
Good God, Ephraim, is this how you court a girl? I took a deep breath and it rattled through my lungs, frantic, erratic. Sneaking off in the middle of the day to see a man hanged?
The courting is done, Ephraim said, and it took a bit of effort to suppress his smile. All that's left now is the marrying. I wanted to answer that hidden smile with one of my own, but couldn't seem to find one. Besides, he added, it didn't take much convincing.
He tensed when I said, Father told me you testified.
Ephraim was taller, but only by a couple of inches, and his wide blue eyes looked over the top of my head to rest on the scene below. He shrugged, his voice purposefully devoid of emotion.
I told them what I saw.
Them. Five men. Just a handful of town elders, my father included, who'd met the night before to see what could be done about a man such as Billy Crane. I shuddered. They hadn't let me in the meeting at all. The clearing had emptied, and I searched it in a panic for my parents. I couldn't see them. We have to get back, or they will know you brought me.
Ephraim seemed unconcerned. Not yet, he said. They can wait.
I was about to protest when he nodded toward the base of the hill. A dark-clad figure began climbing toward us. He took the hill in a series of long, purposeful strides, and the moment I recognized him, I tensed.
What is he doing here?
Ephraim didn't answer. Instead, he stepped between us, so that I was partially hidden in the shadows beneath the tree. He grabbed the man's hand.
Joseph, thank you for coming. Of course.
Joseph North was young and handsome, and the humble words did nothing to hide the flush of excitement that rose above his collar. He'd given the deciding vote that had sealed Crane's fate.
Do you still need me this evening? Yes.
Ephraim peered at the sun, judged its angle in the sky.
4 o'clock. Make sure you bring the documents. I want it official. You caught me just in time, then. I leave first thing in the morning to join my regiment. We ride for Fort Beauséjour. Our orders are to force the natives out of Acadia.
He gave Ephraim a last thoughtful glance, then tipped his hat to me.
Martha?
Joseph North turned and marched back down the hill. When he was out of earshot, I stepped away from Ephraim, suspicion pinching the corners of my eyes. What was that about?
I've asked Joseph to be at your parents' when I take you home.
My father will be furious, but I hardly think legal protection is in order to marry us. I blinked.
What?
Ephraim took one hand with great care, as though lifting a robin's egg from a nest.
It's been only 2 weeks since.
He wasn't typically one to shy away from comment, but he couldn't seem to find the words for this. He cleared his throat, blushed, ran a finger along the base of my thumb. I know how long it's been. I tried to yank my hand away, but he clamped it into his own.
Your cycle, Ephraim finally stammered. It hasn't come yet, has it?
You can't know that.
Am I wrong?
My silence was answer enough.
Have you considered what will happen if you're with child?
I heard the strike before I felt the sting in my palm, but it was the pain that brought me to my senses.
How dare you?
He wasn't hurt so much as startled, but he grabbed both of my wrists and pulled them to his chest to prevent me from doing it again. He shook me just a bit, and I felt my teeth rattle.
What was that for? He demanded.
I won't have you marry me out of pity.
You don't think I want you anymore?
How could you?
There, it was the truth, the unspoken tension between us. Ephraim's entire body trembled with rage. I was afraid he would shake me again, or kiss me. I couldn't tell which to expect by the look on his face. He did neither, in fact, but rather lowered his face until it was an inch from mine.
Let me be clear, he growled, furious. My feelings haven't changed, but I need to know if yours have.
I was overwhelmed,
terrified even. But I shook my head because I did want to marry him. I always had.
Ephraim crushed me against his chest, my arms pinned between us, before I could register his immense relief. He buried a hand in my hair, rubbing little circles against my scalp with his thumb.
Then you must marry me, tonight. Take my name, and they can never question the legitimacy of any child you ever have.
I was neither small nor delicate. I had much of my father's height, and most of his stubbornness. And when I stood before Ephraim Ballard, I could almost look him in the eye. So I straightened my spine and leaned my forehead against the bridge of his nose.
Take me home then, I said, so we can be married.
2. To housekeeping. December 1789. I'll note you in my book of memory. Look to it well. And say you are well warned. William Shakespeare, Henry VI.